Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is the debut of Your Call's new One Planet series. Every Monday, we'll speak with a range of guests about climate change and what needs to be done to protect our fragile planet. We're kicking off today's show by talking about whether oil companies will be held accountable for misleading the public about climate change and then spending millions of dollars to manufacture doubt. Last week, San Francisco and Oakland separately filed lawsuits against five of the world's biggest oil companies for knowingly causing climate change, sea level rise, and causing billions of dollars in damage to their cities. Both cities want Exxon, Chevron, BP, ConocoPhillips, and Royal Dutch Shell to pay billions for past and future flooding, property damage, sea level rise, and others. San Francisco and Oakland joined several other communities in California and attorneys general in Massachusetts and New York who've been also investigating Exxon over misleading the public about fossil fuels' role in global warming. The growing legal actions against Exxon in particular stem from a 2015 investigation by the nonprofit Inside Climate News, the Columbia University School of Journalism, and the LA Times. And the investigation revealed how Exxon conducted cutting-edge climate research decades ago, and then, without revealing all that it had learned, worked at the forefront of climate denial, manufacturing doubt about the scientific consensus that its own scientists had confirmed. Neela Banerjee worked on that investigation. She's a reporter for Inside Climate News, and she joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Neela. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And last month, scientists came out with their own assessments. Harvard University researchers Jeffrey Supron and Naomi Oreskes reviewed 187 Exxon documents and found that the company misled the public about climate science and its implications for decades. They published their findings in environmental research letters. Jeffrey Supron is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of History of Science at Harvard University, and he joins us from Boston. Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
It's great to have you. Neela, I want to start off with you. For listeners who need a refresher into your investigation, Exxon, The Road Not Taken, just give us a thumbnail sketch of what you all found.
Okay. Well, one thing I would like to make clear, though, is that a lot of people draw a parallel between Exxon and tobacco as far and accuse Exxon of suppressing the results that it found in its research in the 70s and 80s. It didn't suppress that research. It just turned away from it and elevated a lot of skepticism at a time when skepticism was diminishing in scientific circles. But what we found was that Exxon began to very closely follow climate research when it was studied in among a small circle of scientists, perhaps back in the middle to late 1970s, and that this monitoring of climate science was driven by concerns about what Exxon believed would be an eventual policy response to climate change. The science, even at that time, was showing that emissions from fossil fuel combustion of fossil fuels was driving changes in the global climate, and that Exxon expected there to be laws or regulations to rein in those emissions, which would have an effect on the company's business. So the company at the time, through the 70s and 80s, did research that was published in peer-reviewed journals. It often worked with esteemed scientists of the day. It funded its own tanker to be outfitted with bespoke equipment to measure CO2 in the water and the atmosphere on a route that the tanker took from the Caribbean to the Persian Gulf and back. So, and the reason it did this was not only to understand the science, but because the company felt that when that policy response came, they wanted to have a seat at the table, and they wanted to be able to go in there showing that they had taken good faith steps to understand the problem and to and they wanted to work with policymakers to fashion a response to it. And this all went on until about the middle 80s. And at that time, Exxon, you know, through the 80s, was going through lots of cutbacks, staff cutbacks, and it pared back the science that it was doing on climate change. But one of it continued, but it was much less ambitious. But the big thing that happened starting in the late 80s was a shift in its public pronouncements about climate change. If in scientific circles before it accepted the science and the doubts that it was voicing were in line with the doubts that the community had, it was much different starting in the late 80s, where it elevated doubt and played down the growing certainty that was emerging in scientific circles.
You said something interesting in your opening remarks. You said it's important to note that unlike the tobacco companies, Exxon didn't suppress the information, it turned away from it. Can you elaborate on this? Because so many of the reports that I've been reading connect this, or at least say that it's like what the tobacco industry did.
I think the parallels that people see and have documented is more in the tactics of playing up uncertainty and hiring scientists who have a particular agenda. In fact, scientists who'd worked to cast doubt on the health science around tobacco, you know, ended up working in the climate science denial movement too. It's, you know, a lot of them are the same people. So in that way, sort of, you know, casting doubt, playing up the uncertainty, those were tactics that were similar. But from what we saw, the science that Exxon did, you know, we found it, right? It wasn't that it was buried and somebody put it on our doorstep. I mean, we, you know, talked to people and amassed documents and looked in archives. So in that way, it was different. Now, whether there's a level of culpability with that Exxon and other fossil fuel companies share in the eyes of the law, as tobacco did, you know, that's something for attorneys general, Justice Department, SEC, all of those people to determine. But, you know, but we did not see a silencing of the scientists inside Exxon, at least mm-hmm. not in the research we did.
Jeffrey, before you talk about the research that you did with Naomi Oreskes, what was your response when you read Inside Climate News, Exxon, the Road Not Taken investigation back in 2015?
Yeah, I was very inspired by the work. It was obviously exemplary investigative journalism, and clearly, you know, our work in no way means all our work does is add to that work by providing an independent, empirical and expansive corroboration of their finding that ExxonMobil has for decades known about the basics of climate science and its implications. So the work by Neela and other journalists was certainly a platform that formed the basis for our peer-reviewed study.
You and Naomi Oreskes, and we've had her on the show many times, reviewed 187 Exxon documents. How did you get your hands on these documents?
Well, as Neela was saying, most of these were public documents. Just to set the scene, ExxonMobil obviously has said that the allegations against it are false and that anyone who looks into the evidence will see that. They've challenged the public to, quote, read the documents. They literally said, read all of these documents and make up your own mind. And so what we did was take up that challenge. Over the past year or so, we have read all of the documents, analyzed them according to established social science methods, and made up our minds. And the documents we looked at were, firstly, Exxon's internal memos that formed the basis of the stories written by Neela and her fellow journalists against the company. I believe that these journalists unearthed these from public ExxonMobil archives in Texas and elsewhere. We then looked at the company's peer-reviewed and non-peer-reviewed publications, all of which were in the public domain and, in fact, offered explicitly by ExxonMobil in rebuttal to accusations against it. And then we looked at the company's advertorials, so-called advertorials, paid advertisements on the op-ed page of the New York Times, which obviously are also publicly available and served as a proxy for the company's public communications.
So you found, when you looked at the 187 documents, 83% of peer-reviewed papers authored by Exxon scientists and 80% of the company's internal communications acknowledged that climate change was real and caused by humans. In contrast, only 12% of Exxon's advertisements directed at the public did so. 81% expressed doubt.
That's correct. We discovered systematic discrepancies between what the company said about climate change privately and in academic circles versus what it said to the general public in the form of these paid advertorials in the New York Times. So in other words, our analysis showed that ExxonMobil has misled the public about climate science and its implications. It did so by contributing quietly to climate science and loudly to raising doubts about it. And this really, I think it's important to reiterate Neela's original point about the fact that no one has said that ExxonMobil has, quote, hidden or, quote, suppressed climate science. This is what the company has claimed, essentially as a straw man gambit to distract attention from the actual findings of journalists and our peer-reviewed work. Our analysis shows that ExxonMobil has misled the public, and the company has yet to address that point.
And Neela, what was your response when you read this latest scientific research?
Well, I was really glad that Jeffrey and Naomi took up Exxon's challenge to look at their record. And I just find the split between their science and their peer-reviewed science and their public narrative striking. I mean, it's almost a direct opposite, right? If you 80% in peer-reviewed circles, internal communications, you know, 80% of those communications accepting the prevailing evidence about climate change driven by fossil fuel emissions, and yet what they're telling to the public is the direct opposite, that 80% of those advertorials cast doubt on that very science that they accept internally.
And then to add to this, a recent study by the Union of Concerned Scientists found that Chevron, ConocoPhillips, BP, Shell, Peabody Energy, and other fossil fuel companies also knowingly worked to deceive the public about the realities and the risks of climate change. It also found that fossil fuel emissions are responsible for as much as half of global surface temperature increases and about 30% of global sea level rise. So, Neela, when this came out, it added names to this growing list.
It did, and you know, there was a study that we wrote about earlier in the summer, done by an investigative think tank, about how utilities also knew back in the 70s and 80s about climate risks. That study was done by the Energy and Policy Institute, and again, you know, they have the documents, and people can look at the digitized documents. And so there seems to be an emerging picture that companies that produced fossil fuels or were big users of fossil fuels or big energy users knew about the science around climate change. When you think about it, it makes sense, right? I mean, they're supposed to monitor short-term and long-term threats to the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's the fossil fuel companies or the utilities or individual companies knowing this, it's all coming together as a picture of broad knowledge within the American industrial sector about climate change much earlier than the general public, and then their decisions about what to do with that knowledge.
Neela Banerjee is a reporter for the nonprofit news organization Inside Climate News. In 2015, Inside Climate News and the LA Times revealed how Exxon conducted cutting-edge climate research decades ago and then worked at the forefront of climate denial. We're also joined by Harvard University's Jeffrey Supron. Jeffrey is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of History of Science at Harvard, and he and Naomi Oreskes reviewed 187 Exxon documents and found that it misled the public about climate science and its implication for decades. And this is the debut of Your Calls One Planet series. Every Monday, we will speak with a range of guests about issues connected to climate change and what needs to be done to protect our fragile planet. And we're kicking off today's show by talking about how oil companies should be held accountable for misleading the public about climate change. Jeffrey, what were your thoughts and what really struck you about the Union of Concerned Scientists report called the Climate Deception Dossiers? They looked at 85 internal memos totaling more than 330 pages, and the seven dossiers reveal a range of deceptive tactics deployed by the fossil fuel industry. They found forged letters to Congress, secret funding of a supposedly independent scientist, the creation of fake grassroots organizations, efforts to manufacture uncertainty, and so much more.
Yeah, I mean, it really seems consistent with our finding, you know, our peer-reviewed work looking at ExxonMobil's climate communication specifically. We identified a track record of sending mixed messages about climate change. And, you know, so it, as Neela was describing, it's not that surprising, really, that gradually journalists, historians, and others are beginning to unearth similar evidence pertaining to other companies and interests around fossil fuel extraction and combustion. Obviously, the specifics vary from company to company, but clearly a trend is emerging here.
And what do you both think of the lawsuits that we're now seeing? Oakland and San Francisco filed separate lawsuits last week against five of the world's biggest oil companies. They say that they knowingly caused climate change, sea level rise, and Neela, they also said that these companies are causing billions of dollars in damage to their cities. And like I said, they join other communities here in California and then attorneys general in Massachusetts and New York.
Well, if I recall correctly, there was a case years ago on behalf of a community in Alaska, Kivalina, that the community lost in trying to hold fossil fuel companies accountable for their contribution to climate change. Now, that said, there's the lawsuits that you mentioned. There, the attorneys general of New York and Massachusetts are looking into Exxon. They haven't issued any indictments, but they've issued subpoenas. They're investigating. They've asked for documents. There's also a lawsuit that was brought against the federal government under President Obama and continues under President Trump by a group of young plaintiffs who've alleged that the federal government also knew very early about fossil fuel contributions to climate change and did not take action and instead continued to encourage the development of fossil fuels. So there's a lot of litigation. It's still unclear when this is going to play out and whether this will hold either the federal government or companies to any kind of account for their actions. And if there's one thing that you can say about fossil fuel companies is that they are diligent about fighting these challenges, and I think it's going to take a really long time for these lawsuits to get resolved.
What do you think, Jeffrey?
Well, we talked earlier about analogies between the fossil fuel industry and the tobacco industry. I do feel as though I'm seeing a gradual crystallization of this litigative picture, somewhat analogous to that of Big Tobacco. It's very important for me to clarify that I'm not a lawyer, Naomi's not a lawyer. We are scientists and academics doing peer-reviewed studies, whose work we believe might be relevant to ongoing investigations and lawsuits. But I really do see essentially ExxonMobil and other fossil fuel interests coming under increasing scrutiny on multiple legal fronts. As you mentioned, we've got everyone from the Attorneys General of New York and Massachusetts to the Securities and Exchange Commission investigating the company, and now lawsuits being filed, not actually just by California communities and others, but actually by some of ExxonMobil's own employees and shareholders. And in one way or another, all these different investigations and lawsuits are asking different themes on the same question, and that's, have ExxonMobil's communications about climate change misled its customers, shareholders, or the general public, including in ways that may have broken the law? And so, as these investigations and lawsuits build and the evidence begins to build too, in the form of investigative journalism, our own work, and that by the Union of Concerned Scientists, it seems like the pieces may be falling slowly into place.
It sounds like we might get more lawsuits. Sean Hecht, co-executive director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change, told the Chronicle that with the federal administration pulling back, it doesn't surprise me that more people are turning to the courts. He says it's possible that the courts will be more sympathetic to claims when there isn't concurrent federal regulatory action moving forward. What do you think about that, Neela?
That makes a great deal of sense to me. And to make clear, I mean, the suits address different aspects of their responsibility to different communities. So one of the things, for example, that the attorneys general are looking at is, it's not just misleading people on some kind of ethical basis, but it actually has to do with investors, right? That if you are internally, as a company, looking at the risk that climate change poses to your projects, that if there's going to be regulation that's going to prevent you from developing the oil deposits that you have, then maybe the value of your company is less than you're saying publicly because of the threats that climate change legislation poses to your assets. And so those are the kinds of things that they're looking at, and which approaches could actually score a direct hit on Exxon and others. I think it's still too early to tell, but the proliferation of these cases is interesting, and I'd agree that a lot of it has to do with the fact that the Justice Department, even under Obama, really wasn't moving quickly on this.
Mm. Jeffrey, what would you add?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting observation that there are different facets to these ongoing legal issues. On the one hand, we have, as Neela was alluding to, the sort of shareholder responsibility angle. Interestingly, our work found that the topic of stranded fossil fuel assets was discussed and sometimes quantified in 24 documents of various types, but notably absent from the highly public advertorials. And clearly this kind of information may be relevant to ongoing investigations, specifically about whether ExxonMobil has properly disclosed the risks of their assets becoming stranded by climate policy. On the other hand, there's also legal questions, you know, more regarding the public. I think, you know, I've even heard talk regarding Hurricanes Harvey and Irma and Maria and Jose and all the others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously these are climate-catalyzed events, severely impacting people's lives, you know, as well as monetary and economic impact. And so much like suits that have so far been filed regarding climate-induced or climate-catalyzed impact, I think it's not beyond question that we might expect further suits, much larger perhaps in value, to follow, and so the pressure to build. It's notable that recently the Union of Concerned Scientists and some independent academics published a peer-reviewed study quantifying, actually providing an accounting framework that links emissions from specific fossil fuel companies to actual global warming temperature rise and sea level rise. And obviously this is, again, an academic study, not a legal or financial approach, but it presents one potential avenue for a framework for quantifying and accounting for the contributions of specific producers to sea level rise and in turn impacts.
Before we go to break, Jeffrey, you brought up the hurricanes and the flooding that we're seeing, and we've done some shows about the questions that we can answer and the questions that we can't answer as these disasters relate to climate change. What are your thoughts about how these conversations are happening, what you're hearing in media coverage?
Well, I'm not hearing enough.
Yeah.
That's the fundamental point. That,
right.
Unfortunately, society, both with regard to these hurricanes and actually just generally over the years, or, you know, over these recent times, there is a systemic form of what some climate communication experts have dubbed climate silence. It's crazy. Last year, for example, 2016, hottest year on record, signing of the Paris Climate Agreement, and so much more, cable news networks collectively spent 50 minutes talking about climate change. I think that history will judge us very sharply for this abrogation in responsibility for covering, you know, the greatest stories of our time, of which climate change is certainly at the very top. And so, yeah, when it comes to the hurricanes, again, there has been, unfortunately, generally speaking, a failure to connect the dots between these record events and climate change, which clearly is providing a warming background to them. So yeah, it's been very frustrating, and you know, kudos to all the journalists who have done great work joining those dots.
Jeffrey Supran is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of History of Science at Harvard University. He and Naomi Oreskes reviewed 187 Exxon documents and found that the company misled the public about climate science and its implications for decades. And you can read their findings at yourcallradio.org. Neela Banerjee is a reporter with the nonprofit Inside Climate News. In 2015, Inside Climate News and the LA Times revealed how Exxon conducted conducted cutting-edge climate research decades ago, and then without revealing what it had learned, it worked at the forefront of climate denial, manufacturing doubt about the scientific consensus that its own scientists had confirmed. This is Your Call, and today it's our debut of our One Planet series. Every Monday, we'll speak with a range of guests about issues connected to climate change and what needs to be done to protect our fragile planet. We're kicking off today's show by talking about how oil companies should be held accountable for misleading the public about climate change. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are debuting our One Planet series. Every Monday, we'll speak with a range of guests about issues connected to climate change and what needs to be done to protect our planet. And we're kicking off today's show by talking about how oil companies should be held responsible and accountable for misleading the public about climate change and spending millions of dollars to manufacture doubt. Last week, San Francisco and Oakland separately filed lawsuits against five of the biggest oil companies for knowingly causing climate change, sea level rise, and causing billions of dollars in damage to their cities. And they joined several other communities in California, attorneys general in Massachusetts and New York. And then a lawsuit was filed against the federal government by a group of young plaintiffs who allege the federal government also knew about climate change. And we're talking with this about this today with Neela Banerjee, reporter with the nonprofit Inside Climate News. In 2015, Inside Climate News and the LA Times had a major investigation about how Exxon conducted cutting-edge climate research decades ago and then, without revealing what it had learned, worked at the forefront of climate denial. We're also joined by Jeffrey Supron, postdoctoral fellow in the Department of History of Science at Harvard University. He and his colleague Naomi Oreskes reviewed 187 Exxon documents and found that it misled the public about climate science and its implication for decades. Neela, before the break, we were talking about how the media are covering the hurricanes and the floods. And we've done shows looking at the questions that we can answer and the questions that we still can't answer. And when the cable shows were doing 24/7 coverage about what was about to hit Texas, they rarely mentioned climate change. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, there's obviously a very different way that the broadcast media covers it versus print media. But what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's a real disservice to their viewers in explaining not just what's happening now, but what they can expect in the future. For people to plan accordingly about how they're going to live, where they're going to live, they need to have all the information, and very often cable news doesn't provide that. Now, I think sometimes the question is framed incorrectly. People want to say, well, was Harvey caused by climate change? And there's still uncertainty about some aspects many aspects of hurricane science, but a lot of it, what is clear is that if hurricanes occur, which they will, in the Atlantic, in the Gulf of Mexico, because that's what happens, this supercharges them, right? The way scientists compare it is they use the analogy of steroids. You know, that somebody might be a good athlete, but if they take steroids, it makes them an even better athlete. And it's the same thing with the way climate change works, is that it takes natural events in particular parts of the world, whether drought in parts of the world that are dry or hurricanes or monsoons in places where you have those kinds of seasons, and really amps them up. And so that's what you know, that's what was missed. That opportunity was missed. And you know, there's certainly things that people are uncertain, scientists are uncertain about, that, like, they're looking into, for example, why Harvey stalled over Texas for so long. Is that driven by climate change? Is it not? But the fact that the oceans are getting warmer, that means that there's more moisture being taken up into the atmosphere. That's not in doubt.
Mm-hmm. Right. Jeffrey, what would you add?
Yeah, I'd basically add that, you know, that when we cover climate change, when we cover hurricanes, obviously and without doubt, the top priority has to be that, you know, these people are having the worst days of their lives and they have to be helped. And obviously, one has to focus on the day-to-day and the immediate impact. The incredible, incredibly kind of short-sighted assertion, though, from Scott Pruitt of the EPA and others, that at the same time, I think in his words, it was very, very insensitive to talk about how climate change might be contributing to these events. It's nonsense, because joining the dots between climate change and these increasingly, you know, record-breaking events is actually highly prudent in terms of leadership. We need to identify that flags are being raised, giant red flags are you know, flapping in front of us, and these events provide an opportunity for us to respond to an intensifying problem, to protect others, to protect you know, the livelihoods of future communities, not to mention economic impact. Mm. It's important to clarify, I'm not a climate scientist. My expertise are in renewable energy and disinformation. But for, you know, for any listeners who haven't kind of heard the basics of how climate change relates to hurricanes, it's primarily in three ways, and I feel comfortable discussing it sort of at a relatively fundamental level. Firstly, you know, warmer water, we know that when water's warm, we get more vapor in the atmosphere, and that means that when these storms move in, they have more water content to drop on our communities. Second, obviously, sea level is rising due to warming waters and melting ice caps. This means that storm surges brought into land by these storms are that much higher, meaning they move that much further inland, cause that much more devastation. And thirdly, and this is slightly less secure, but scientists also are increasingly confident that when you warm water, you give it more energy. You give it more power to drive ever more intense storms. And so, you know, it seems unsurprising that we're now seeing all of these record events.
You brought up disinformation. Can you both talk about what struck you about these disinformation campaigns over the last couple decades and how they really shaped public opinion? Neela?
Well, I think it's interesting that we're discussing how cable news reports on hurricanes, because in many ways you can draw a line from what is said or goes unsaid now back to these disinformation campaigns that are perhaps less visible or more sophisticated now. You know, what's happened in the United States as opposed to other industrialized countries is that it is perfectly acceptable for a major political party, for the President of the United States, for people who run federal agencies, for an enormous portion of an educated, literate public to deny climate change. And so I think the networks and the cable news networks are reacting to that. They're skittish about what they would probably consider unnecessarily bringing up a controversy. They probably don't have staff reporters who really understand the ins and outs of this. So the question is, how did we get to this point, right? And we got to this point because of millions of dollars spent over decades to sow doubt about the certainty, the growing certainty of the science. And I think one of the functions of American journalism is that you know, we want to be fair to both sides, so we basically presented, we reporters, including in print media, including in major publications like the New York Times and others, we presented what we considered to be both sides of the argument. And it took us all a long time, including in print media, to pull back away from that and to say, well, basically, this is where reality lies, and this is a politically motivated narrative held by very few people and being funded by industry for its own purposes. so that's happened in print media, but it hasn't happened in the media that most people consume, which is TV.
Right.
And so, you know, so what you're seeing in this reticence on, in network news is really the fruit of years of this kind of denial being successfully sown within American public thinking.
What would you add to that, Jeffrey?
Well, so obviously it is harder to directly link any form of specific disinformation or misinformation or, you know, absence of information to specific very large societal responses and viewpoints. That's an incredibly messy sort of sociopolitical problem. That said, I think that there is overwhelming evidence that the disinformation campaigns perpetuated by ExxonMobil and other fossil fuel interests, both directly through what they said themselves and through third parties, through think tanks, lobby groups, and climate-denying politicians, these actions have had impacts on both societal and political levels. You know, just as a couple of data points, when the United States decided not to ratify the Kyoto Protocol, you know, an early sort of late 90s effort to bring climate policy to this issue, the Bush White House explicitly in writing wrote to thank ExxonMobil for its contribution to this ultimate decision. And we've seen, you know, through internal documents, ExxonMobil's efforts to lobby the White House on this. And indeed, they tried to do so in editorials in the New York Times, too. At a much more sort of granular level, behavioral scientists have studied the psychological impacts, specifically of the editorials we looked at, on test participants, and found that these editorials do have an impact on people's understanding of climate science and their willingness to do something about it. I don't think it's necessarily a coincidence that the United States, the one country where fossil fuel interests have arguably been most prolific in their disinformation and misinformation, is also now you know, the only country with a leader in the entire world who denies the basics of climate science and its implications, President Trump. Obviously, today, there has been an evolution in the rhetoric of fossil fuel interests because, you know, they have to survive. You know, there's an evolution in what is plausibly, you know, permissible these days. And yet the same track records of sending mixed messages, I believe, we still see. ExxonMobil and other fossil fuel companies say that they acknowledge climate science and that they want to adhere to the Paris Climate Agreement, but they continue to double down on a business model that's incompatible with stopping climate change. You know, the company also says it supports a carbon tax, but it overwhelmingly gives money to congresspeople who don't. And, you know, the evidence has emerged that they're actively lobbying against carbon tax efforts, for example, right here in Massachusetts.
This is an important point because now we have Exxon's former CEO is the Secretary of State of the United States. The Guardian had a piece a few years ago about a paper that was published at the University of Bergen in Norway, and it compared the climate positions of conservative political parties around the world. It looked at the U.S., the UK, Norway, Sweden, Spain, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and Germany. And it found that the US Republican Party stands alone in its rejection of the need to tackle climate change, saying that Republicans in the United States would be a fringe in any other country. Jeffrey, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's without doubt, you know, right now, up until recently, it was United States, Syria and Nicaragua, who weren't part of the Paris Climate Accord. Nicaragua wasn't part of it because it felt like the Paris Agreement wasn't ambitious enough, and it recently announced that it is going to, you know, join the Paris Agreement, I think because it doesn't like the company it's part of. And so essentially, you know, President Trump is now the only leader in the entire world who denies the basic realities of climate science. And so, yeah, we're in a very dire spot. But I think that the hope that can be found, the silver lining, if you like, is that the Trump administration has essentially rendered, you know, the federal government quite ineffectual when it comes to U.S. climate leadership. And that actually greatly empowers state and local level leadership, where you and I actually have, you know, greater levers of impact. And so if there's a silver lining, it's that perhaps collective action and more people power can actually have greater impact on U.S. climate policy now.
Silver lining, Neela, what are your thoughts on that?
I think I would differ with Jeffrey on that somewhat, maybe just because by nature I'm perhaps more pessimistic, I don't know, but I feel that certainly work on the local level, work among corporations and individuals and municipalities is crucial, regardless of whether there's federal policy or not. The problem becomes that in the absence of federal policy, what you're going to see on the on those levels that we've described will be piecemeal and inadequate, that you'll have some places forging ahead and other places that aren't going to do anything. And, you know, the federal government sets a bar, it sets ambitions, it offers carrots and sticks, and those have enormous influence, and those have been revoked by this administration. And the question is whether, you know, at some point the United States, the public is going to demand action. Mm-hmm. And the question is it going to be too late? Is it going to be too late for your kids and your grandkids? And does that really matter to you?
Nila Banerjee is a reporter for the nonprofit Inside Climate News. In 2015, Inside Climate News and the LA Times worked on a massive investigation, Exxon, The Road Not Taken. Exxon's own research confirmed fossil fuels' role in global warming decades ago. We're also joined today by Jeffrey Supron, postdoctoral fellow in the Department of History of Science at Harvard University. He and Naomi Oreskes reviewed 187 Exxon documents and found that it misled the public about climate science and its implication for decades. And then a recent study by the Union of Concerned Scientists added a couple names, actually many names, to a list: Chevron, ConocoPhillips, BP, Shell, Peabody Energy, and other fossil fuel companies also knowingly work to deceive the public about the realities and risks of climate change. The question is, how should they be held accountable? Last week, San Francisco and Oakland separately filed lawsuits against five of these companies for knowingly causing climate change. And today it is the debut of our One Planet series. Every week we'll speak with a range of guests about climate change and what needs to be done to protect our planet. I want to ask both of you, at a time when doubt is so strong, these doubt campaigns, and the revolving door continues to spin, The Intercept is reporting that Exxon may soon have a greater hand in shaping the science used to develop major environmental regulations. The published list of potential names for the Science Advisory Board and the EPA Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee includes many industry reps and consultants. So this is where we're at. Nila, you know, if you talk to someone who does watch a lot of television and believes a lot of these denial campaigns, I mean, how do you talk to someone about your findings?
You know, that's really interesting. And one of the people I look to who I think does a very good job in reaching out to folks who might be who might deny climate change and climate science is the climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe, who is based in Lubbock, Texas at Texas Tech. And she really makes it a point to go to small community gatherings, churches, professional organizations of engineers in Texas, and so on. And I think, you know, what she uses some very good analogies, right? She does a very good she very clearly explains how the climate science works, right? That this is something that we've known since the 19th century. It's a basic chemical process that when carbon through combustion is released into the atmosphere, it binds with oxygen, and you have carbon dioxide, and that we actually do have carbon dioxide covering the earth. It's like a blanket, and the analogy she uses is, if you're lying in bed and you have a blanket and you put another blanket on, don't you get uncomfortable? So that first blanket makes life possible, but more CO2 makes things uncomfortable on earth, and people start to get that. Mm-hmm. And then when people say, well, you know, 1.5 degrees Celsius, I mean, who cares? That doesn't sound like much to me. And what she often points out is that, think of your own body, right? That if you're at 98.6 degrees, that's your normal temperature. If it goes up by a degree or two, you know, that's a fever. That means you're sick. It's the same thing with the planet. And that also registers with people. She also points out that the certainty about that climatologists have about the science and of fossil fuel combustion contributing to greater CO2 and warming of the planet is as certain as the science around tobacco, and other climatologists say this too. So I think it's sort of, it's not talking down to people, but it's kind of making things that seem abstract clear. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, I think with some people it registers. Now, part of the problem is that, you know, that the denial campaign has so succeeded in making climate denial a pillar of certain identities, especially conservative American identities, that it's really hard to break through that sense of tribalism. I mean, I've spoken to people who, you know, who have been involved in cleaning up the environment, but they are politically conservative. So when you ask them about climate change, they're like, well, yeah, I think, you know, fossil fuels contribute to it, but there are other things too, like the sun or volcanoes. These are all arguments that have been debunked by climatologists, but they cling to that because to be a conservative for many people, not everybody, means to deny man-made climate change or to at least make it not a big issue, and that is, you know, that's a really big hurdle to get over.
Mm. Jeffrey, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's I mean Neela really hit the nail on the head, and I don't think I have very much original to add, other than to note that as Neela was alluding to, there are different constituencies that we need to think about in terms of speaking, messaging in ways that make sense to them. So to people who perhaps watch a lot of cable news and maybe get a sense from the conversation we're having or just from watching the news that they may be misled or getting a rather one-dimensional perspective on all of this. I think the print media is doing a much better job in ensuring that the science is at the forefront of their climate coverage. So, I'd encourage people to read newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post. The New York Times' climate reporter, Justin Gillis, has this incredible answers to hard questions on climate. It's a very small article that I'd strongly encourage everyone to not only read but to share, because it's a one-stop shop for your kind of climate 101. More independent outlets like Inside Climate News, where Neela is, do fantastic work. Dave Roberts at Vox, as Neela mentioned, Catherine Hayhoe is an incredible climate scientist who people should follow for a very different perspective and a great climate communication. And skepticalscience.com also is really a unique resource for debunking all of the myths of climate skeptics. So they even have a phone app. I'd encourage people to look at that. For those people wanting to not only sort of increase their information flow, but also help address this problem, as I was saying before, what we need to do is end climate silence. Hmm. That means more of us having more conversations about not just what climate change is, but why it matters. So it's key to remember that values, not facts, are the currency of persuasion. And so we have to talk about why this problem matters to me. I'm 29, I just got my PhD, but a few years ago, my family's house was, threatened by the worst flooding in a quarter century back in the UK. My girlfriend comes from Bangkok, a city which will be gone if we continue on our current trajectory.
Wow.
We have to talk about why this matters to us. But as Neela also mentioned, tribalism and political ideology are at the core of entrenched climate denialism. And to be frank, it may be impossible to move some people on that. But what we need to remember is that we're not going to reach everyone, and we don't actually need to, arguably, in order to make more progress on climate change. We, as with technologies, as with most social movements, it's usually an engaged and energized minority that leads the way.
Right. And
so
they,
myself, yeah, I'm very excited about mobilizing young people.
Yeah, you're right. And they tend to get the microphone. In our remaining minutes, going back to these lawsuits, these cities are saying we don't have more time to debate this issue that is not being debated in other countries. So, for example, the Chronicle reports that San Francisco officials expect to pay about $500 million to fortify the 3-mile seawall along the Embarcadero to prevent roads, homes, businesses from being submerged. Long-term upgrades are projected to cost about $5 billion. I mean, we're talking about a lot of money here. And Sean Hecht, the co-executive director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change, says the question is whether the courts will conclude that there is causation and that the harm outweighed the benefits provided to the public. Nila, what will you be looking for specifically as these lawsuits move forward?
I think what we'll be looking for, I mean, what I'm interested in as a journalist is whether the courts will be able to pry information from the fossil fuel companies and from the government that explains this pivot away from, especially with the fossil fuel companies and Exxon, the pivot away from the science that they were looking at in the 70s and 80s to denial. If they can actually shed light on corporate decisions that were made about that, I think will be interesting. And as far as the success of the courts, then the question is, you know, how do you explain those pivots? And can companies be held accountable to the tune of millions or billions of dollars? Or is this normal, you know, corporate decision making, and companies make mistakes, and maybe their denial campaign was a mistake? So those are things that, because I'm not a lawyer, I can't judge. But more of the picture being filled in would I think help us understand how we got to this point. And really, that's what we're trying to do at Inside Climate, is that we're trying to understand how we got to this point in this rare space that the United States occupies of openly denying science.
Jeffrey, what about you? What will you be looking at specifically?
Well, I think that there are many more documents out there, some that we have, some that we don't have. And so this is fertile territory for future work by investigative journalists, academics such as ourselves, and legal experts. And so, you know, I and Nila, I'm sure, will be working more on sort of seeing what other evidence and information is out there. So we'll be very curious to see how these pieces of the jigsaw puzzle start to fit together. I'll also be particularly curious to see how long it is before the public starts to really ask very vociferously, how much longer do we have to foot the entire bill for these climate-catalyzed events? Right now, the taxpayer entirely covers the cost of these events. And, you know, to give you a sense, Hurricane Harvey is estimated to have some kind of impact on the order of $150 to $200 billion. The recent Union of Concerned Scientists study indicates that Exxon, Chevron, BP are responsible for about 6% of climate-induced sea level rise. One very basic form of accounting might be to say, well, what's 6% of $150 to $200 billion? You're talking about on the order of $10 billion that, you know, might be accountable to some extent by these companies. And right now, these three companies collectively have pledged around $2.5 to $3 million. And so I'll be very curious to see how this dialogue progresses between the public that is impacted by these events and fossil fuel interests.
Jeffrey Supran is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of History of Science at Harvard. He and Naomi Oreskes reviewed 187 Exxon documents and found that it misled the public about climate science and its implications for decades. Nila Banerjee is a reporter for the nonprofit Inside Climate News. She worked on their massive report, Exxon, The Road Not Taken. Exxon's own research confirmed fossil fuels' role in global warming decades ago, and then the company led efforts to block solutions. Jeffrey and Nila, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Your Calls One Planet series is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. If you'd like to sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. We are also on iTunes. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls One Planet series.